Rat 10168, reel number 2.
Mr. Donald Price, reel 2. Now, in January, your papers, you were saying, arrived, 1915.
Yes, the envelope arrived at our house for me. I was expecting some notification, but I didn't expect it so soon. It must have been less than a fortnight after that I'd joined. And it said that I got a report to the exchange station in Manchester at a certain time, and I was going on a train. I'd got to take my pyjamas with me and an extra pair of trousers. And I turned up, I think my brother came with me, and there were a lot of people on this platform. It was on the number one platform, I can see it now. And all these lads, all these men were on there, all on the same game as me. And eventually somebody came and ushered us onto this train. Where we were going was nobody's business. I didn't know where we were going or when or how. What we're supposed to be doing. Anyhow, we rushed into the train, and the next thing, we were off amidst a lot of cheering and waving and etc. My people didn't see me off. My brother was there, but there were a whole crowd of people seeing the train off with the flags and the usual paraphernalia. And eventually we found ourselves down at a place called Leatherhead. And we were allocated billets. And I was allocated with two men. Well, I called the men, they'd probably be 23, 24, but to me they were men. And we were in a house in Leatherhead next to the bridge that goes over the river. I was in a house there. And funny enough, I understand now from a girl who I met on this Saturday that house is still there. So I don't suppose they'll ever see it, but the point is it's still there. And we remained there. We did our parades. Oh, but before that, we were called up to line up in front of a sort of church school. And we were in two lines. I was on the back row. And there must have been probably 50 of us, I think, lined up. And this very, very smart sergeant major came out, and he went right through us all and said, "Now look here, you're in the Royal Fusiliers, the usual good regiment, but the best regiment in the country." And he came along and examined everybody, questioned everybody, and he questioned somebody in front of me, and he said, "How old are you?" And this Parker, Jim Parker, he says, 18, sir." And the sergeant major says, "You're not 18. Step out." And he stepped out, and he was sent home again. But when he came to me, there was no question. Never asked me how old I was. So I must have been looking fairly, fairly ancient even in those days. And
you were told you were in the Royal Fusiliers. This had the 20th Battalion, which is what you eventually became part of. Was that formed then?
That was actually formed. I think the battalion was being made up then of public school people. And there were public school people from London and Manchester and South Wales. And it all came into one group eventually. But we were all in pieces. In those days, there was some in training in, say, in Cardiff, some training where we were, some training in Manchester or somewhere in London. And we didn't eventually join. I don't think we joined up really till later on, when we went to camp.
So at this time, there were only about 50 of you?
About 50 of us in that group.
Mm. At Leatherhead?
At Leatherhead, yes. There are other people at Ashtead and various little places round about then. And eventually, by the time we trained, we'd trained there and collected ourselves about month, 2 months, they're getting us fit, nothing else, running round and all that kind of business.
Right, well, we'll hold there for a minute, because that's what I want to ask you about, that period. Firstly, going back to the billet, I think, what kind of a billet was it? It was a private billet.
Oh, yes.
How many were in
there?
Oh,
it was a very lovely billet. There were two men and myself. Very lovely. She was a charming person. I remember, and we did everything there. We slept there, we fed there, and she looked after us just as if you were in digs. And we dressed well, with no uniforms, anything like that. We had our own thing, we had our pyjamas and things like that. We were in the army, although with no uniform. And it wasn't till probably a month after.
Did you have your own room, or were the three of you in the same room?
No, I think I had my own room, but the other two, they were friends, they'd come down together. And I had my own room, and they two were together in a room. But we were all mates. We used to eat together and go out together and things like that. Although they were 23, they accepted me as a soldier. I was a part of the same game. And we used to go, I wouldn't say on the booze, because I never drank as such, because I'd say I'd been so disciplined at home that anything as far as alcohol was concerned was out. But my mother once said to me that she didn't mind sherry. See? No, port wine. She didn't mind port wine. I think we had port wine at church in communion, I think. And I think that's the reason probably that she didn't mind it. And of course, when I got in the army, port wine to me was accepted. Although it was deadly, actually, to me, frankly, it was accepted. And I persisted in it, although I didn't drink much. I certainly felt the effect of port wine on me. I thought, you know, sort of, blimey, I shouldn't be doing this. But I didn't feel guilty about it at all. Although I'd been disciplined at home so strongly about Christianity and drinking and women and all kinds, I had no guilt whatever about drink port wine.
So where would you go drinking with you?
Well, we, of course, in those days, we went in pubs, hotels. You see, you get a place like Leatherhead, and if you've only sort of 50 extra people in, I mean, there wasn't no crowded in pubs or anything like today. And you went there, and of course, the church army, and you began to get a lot of the church army and the YMCA. They started taking over one or two halls and making sort of canteens and giving cups of tea where you could spend your time playing solo or playing cards or whatever, you see. We used to amuse ourselves like that. And there was no amusement at night, only concerts. They'd started getting these concert parties up from London. And
at Leatherhead?
At Leatherhead. They used to come down to Leatherhead and they'd go to Ashton, they'd go to Manchester, these concert parties. And
what sort of show would they put on?
Well, they're quite really. There might be a comedian and say a girl singing and a chap telling, you know, funny stories or something. And they're quite to us when there's nothing else. And I'd seen nothing like it when I was a boy in my village, because the only thing we'd ever saw in my village was a church. Anything happened at a church. And if I ever wanted anything, we used to go to Manchester theatre there, but it cost so much money I never went, say, more than once to the Hippodrome in Manchester. So I didn't realise. I did realise we're having quite accepted, quite nice in their head to have these concert parties down, seeing a nice girl singing, having a port wine, and we passed the night, and then of course you've got, I think we had an extra chap who used to come down to us and we played solo cards or something, you see.
Were you gambling or just playing?
Oh, yes, no, you'd gamble. Gamble like cherries. And I, you see.
How about that with your background? Did you worry about that?
Not a bit. I did eventually. But I always felt a bit guilty about it in one way, and yet no. So long as they, at home, they didn't know, you see. I was all right. And
what sort of stakes was it? Small gambling?
Oh, yeah, it got. You see, I had no money. Don't forget this, that I got 7 shillings a week. And when you'd had a beer, well, everything was not expensive. I mean, beer only probably cost you a penny or something. And I was smoking at the time, too. So, I mean, that cost you a bit, you see. And had the beer, and 7 shillings wasn't a lot of money.
Had you started smoking at Leatherhead?
Oh, yes.
Well?
Yes, oh, well, I used to smoke. So I'd smoked at home, see? And
had your mother approved of that?
Well, she didn't know, actually. I mean, that was the point. We used to keep it very, you know, very sort of secret. Wash your hands when you went in the house and all. I'd take the eat chewing gum so you didn't smell and things like that. But when
relaxing.
If I might just go from that, just one little incident later on, when the war had finished completely, and I'd been wounded, and I went up, and my brother, who was in the army in those days, he said where he was. And he said, I'll come. He found out where I was, and he came over to see me in Belgium when the war was over. And we were playing, when he came in the room, I was playing Panthéon with money on the table. And I felt quite guilty about it. Even then, I felt terrible that my brother had seen me. There was I, a man had been through all this, and my brother came in the room and found me playing, you know, solo or something, and I felt so guilty about it. That's the difference between, you know, my home and my sort of mental attitude, even then, later on in the war, you see.
So your recreations were freer than they had been at
home. Oh, quite, yes.
You wouldn't presumably be able to get drunk with the amount of money.
Oh,
you
I could get drunk. We went from there, from Leatherhead.
At Leatherhead, I mean.
No, not at Leatherhead. I got happy, but I never got drunk at Leatherhead.
How did you get on with the local civilians while you were
out? They were lovely. I mean, they used to look after us. You see, a nice lot of people, this crowd. I don't remember them. I know that the people I was with in the digs, I think one was an accountant, one was a solicitor. They're a really nice type. And, of course, the girls in Leadhead, you know, were nice fellows. And, of course, it was quite a happy time. I never found any, because I was too young to start messing about with a woman in those days. But we were all accepted, and I know this girl in the house would sort of woman I'd talking about 35. I think she took me out to a concert once and things like that, you see. And they didn't last long. We were only there. I don't think we were, it never had more than a month, probably 6 weeks. All we did really was to get up in the morning and get your shorts on and a parade for running. And in Leatherhead, there was a park there, and we used to run round for... this was 6 o'clock in the morning. And we used to run round till breakfast, and then...
What would breakfast be?
At home.
Oh, you went back to your village?
Oh, back to digs. There was no canteen. We just went to digs in those days, you see. And, of course, we were fed. I suppose these women were given very adequate recompense by the government for putting...
What was the food like they gave you? Was it good, wholesome?
Oh, yes. I mean, I was feeding better there than I fed at home. Because, you see, I suppose it was a nice house, and they'd been used to better things, and they were getting so much money from the government to subsidise so many men. And I suppose they'd like to... They had the pleasure in having us. And they made us really comfortable in all ways.
So after breakfast...
After breakfast, well, of course, we paraded again, and the same thing happened. We might go out for a walk, a march. Don't forget, no uniforms yet. We were all civvies, and we used to march, and probably march 5 or 6 miles. We got into the habit of marching then and drilling. I mean, just forming fours had got to be taught. We were raw, completely raw. I mean, even turning right, turn left. It all got to be taught properly, and company drill, marching, forming fours, turning right, left, and wheeling. Everything had got to be taught. When that happened, we'd got this for say a month, and by the time we'd finished, in a month, we pretty well knew what drilling meant. And then,
did you understand the reason for the drilling, or did you find it boring? And
oh, it's tiresome. We used to get fed up with the damn thing, you see, because there was no sense in it as far as we're concerned. We didn't know what it meant. We didn't realise We didn't realise what marching meant. It was part of the discipline. We didn't quite realise that all this was leading up to the very tight discipline that was necessary when we were over in France.
Yeah. So after this morning session of drilling, you'd have lunch, I presume.
Go back home for lunch, and then afternoon we might have map reading or anything. We'd have a rifle, somebody showing us. We hadn't got any, but we'd probably shown the rifle and the parts and how things and what the bayonet was and things like that. And everything had to be learnt.
So it was theoretical?
All the time, yes.
The weapons.
But we had the gun there, and I remember we had this sergeant there, and he was it was what they call a drill instructor. And he had a rifle there, and he was showing us the bolt and how to load it and how to all this kind of business. That lasted about a month. And by the time we'd finished in a month, we were pretty solid as far as company drill is concerned. And then we went to a place called...
So you'd have this afternoon session, then you'd have tea, would you? Would that be back home?
Oh, yes. Back home. You see, I think we finished about four-ish.
And that was it?
That was about it for the day. There was no evening overtime, anything like that.
So you were allowed out?
Oh, yes. Oh, you were free. And there was no... I don't remember in those days there were any red caps about stopping us going in any hotels, like became the normal thing later on. But I don't remember anything like that.
So this carried on for a month, 6 weeks, whatever.
Yes.
So you'd be in
February.
Yes,
it was quite a pleasant time. Actually, I was very, very, very sorry to leave it because the digs were so marvellous. And then we went off to a place called Woodcote Park, which is not very far from Leatherhead, Ashtead, and it's not very far from Epsom, all around the same district. And we were in huts there. At Woodcote Park. And, of course...
What were the huts like? Can you
describe? Oh, they were good. They were quite good. I mean, we'd got the huts were, they're quite good. And we'd go... Everybody got a bed. You know, one of these wire bed things. And you'd got a couple of blankets, I remember, right? Or sheets, anything like that. Just beds. And everybody got a bit of a cupboard above his bed. And there was a big table down the centre. And that was for feeding. Now, that was the difference, that when we were in the camp, a canteen, the cookhouse, and the food was brought in great big, I forget what we call them now.
Dixies?
Big Dixies. And we used to feed on these tables down the centre of the room, you see, and then we used to use them use the centre tables for playing cards or anything like that.
What was the food like?
Well, here? it was began to be, army food. I mean, you got your stews nearly every day, and you got a lump of bacon in the morning. There were no such things as eggs. You got a lump of bacon in the morning, and plenty of bread and plenty of butter, and plenty of cheese about, and more often than not for lunch, a great big stack of stew. More often than not, it was stew. But sometimes you'd get a hunk of beef and somebody give you a chunk of beef or something like that. But that was the general... It was wholesome and plenty of it, but it was crude. See? More often than not, somebody might eventually give you a lump of pudding or a basin of rice or something as a treat. As a sweet, but more often than not, it was quite quite sufficient. There were no complaints about quality or quantity, but there was no finesse about it. Whatever, you know.
Now you're actually out of your billets and into a hut, a more normal army life.
Well, you're going.
How did you react to the army lifestyle and the lack of privacy and the discipline that was?
Well, you just took it as read. You see, you'd come down from your house and you'd slight learning at Leatherhead. You see, things are, you're beginning to realise your friends and, you know, you've got to behave yourself. And he wanted something, you wanted something, and you got to sort of take the rough for the smooth. And you began to realise what friendship was all about, really. And we had a... From there, then, we got our rifles, and we'd got...
Hang on. Did you mind the lack of privacy?
Not a bit. I was a bit nervous, say, of going to the toilet or something like that, but start pissing with somebody else in the same thing. But you got quite used to things like that at home. Being rather a shy nature in the old days, if I had pissed along with somebody, say, in Manchester, I'd always felt a bit nervous, probably couldn't start urinating, you know? But when you're in the army, toilets and things, we got quite used to it. The talk, I think the talk of the soldier became lewd and crude, but you built up to it, you see.
Well, most of the men, it was a public school battalion, I know, as you've told me as well. Were most of the men from public schools, or was there just a high proportion?
Oh, no, most of them were public schools. You see, I got into this public school through no fault of my own. I was in the army. Where I was going to go or what I was going to do, I had not the faintest idea. I found myself in the public school battalion through no fault of my own. I was just shoved in. And I think for the only reason was that probably the public school battalion was just forming. And they wanted to fill it up quick.
Did their background was therefore different from yours? You were from a poorer background.
Yes.
Was that very apparent to
no,
you?
No, it wasn't. They accepted me and I accepted them, you see. I mean, I talked to solicitors and I think I told you that the fellow sleeping next to me was the Honourable F.S. Bligh. He accepted me, I accepted him as Joe. You see, a sort of Christian name. And groups of people, you could smell them. I mean, it's so lovely, their lifestyle that had been, not as it was, but in their lifestyle, you could smell it. You could smell clubs, nice clubs, you could smell nice theatres, you could smell, you know, that kind of thing. And... I totally enjoyed them. They were lovely to me, and I learned a lot in those days.
Did they have more money than you did?
Oh, I mean, God, yes, yes, oh, Lord. I mean, I was a poor man, and I felt very guilty once. These people, they had tons of money, you see, and I was smoking. And I asked one of these fellas once for a cigarette, and he was very cross with me. He said to me something, buy your own, or something like that, and I felt very guilty about it. But I know he'd got plenty, tons of money. And they were loaded with money, some of these. They go, you see, you could get passes. Later on, you got your pass from Woodcote to go to London on the train. You got a pass. I couldn't afford, but these fellas go up every weekend, go to London, you see. I'm not saying for the weekend, for the day. Spend the money, see the women, see the booze. And it was only once I went to a chap. I'm only doing this, I've got a bad neck for the moment. A pal of mine, my sister, who was in South Wales, had some friends down there in Barry. And one of them, a fellow named Frank Webber, he was on the South Wales Echo then. And he was in the 21st Battalion. And they were at Ashthead when we were at Leatherhead, and we all joined at Woodcote Park to make, you see, the battalion. And once he said to me, he said, would you like to come to London, Donna? Yeah, so off we go, London. And he took me in a pub, and I'd never been in a pub before. This pub was owned by an officer, a fellow named Pigash. And I went up this, it was in the Piccadilly, which was a low-down place, and I think we went up there and I drank port. And I was sitting next to a prostitute. My first ever encounter with a prostitute. And she said something to me, and whether I blushed or not, I probably did, I'm not quite certain. But I felt dreadful, you see. And I think we had a couple of port wines, got our booze, and I was very glad to get out of it. But that's my first ever going in what I call a pub, or not a nightclub. It's a real low-down show it was. And when I look back, I was very surprised that Frank took me there, because he was such a lovely chap, you know.
That was different from the sort of hotels of Leatherhead.
Oh, God, yes. There were pubs in London. Well, London, it's a very different setup. I mean, everything was so nice and sort of pure in Leatherhead, but when you got to London, it became tatty, prostitutes, like that. It had stamped, these girls had stamped the name on the place before I ever went in, sort of style, you know. And it didn't hurt me at all.
With these two different levels of income, the people like yourselves and the public school boys, was there any friction or jealousy?
Not a bit. The only thing, of course, I couldn't, you see, more often than not, these fellas gamble every night. Not gambling, they play for a bob of tuppence or threepence. I couldn't join them. I always felt a bit outward. I couldn't quite join them. When I got my 7 shillings, of course, I used to join them in the week. If I had nothing left the next week, well, I couldn't join them. That's how it was, and money was no object whatever. I didn't bother about money. The only thing I bothered about money was I couldn't afford to go to the canteen and buy a pork pie or something, you know.
You say that the language and that things got cruder, you know, the talk of soldiers
got
cruder.
Yes, yes.
How did that happen with all these people from a privileged background? Were they brought down, or did people just...
you're in the army. And when you're in the army, things get rock bottom as far as language goes. I mean, a man is healthy, the first thing he thinks about is a woman. And then the talk becomes woman, about women. And that was right through the army. All through the army, as far as I remember, from my word go right away till I came out of the war.
And that was what you meant by the crudity of...
Oh, yes, yes. It was crude. The whole thing was... To me, it was. But don't forget, to those people who were there, it was natural. The people who occupied these places night after night, it was completely natural.
Would they talk like that in front of you, or would you
Oh, Lord, yes. I mean, Effingham blinding was a common thing, you see, in those days. I mean, people thought nothing about it.
Even from the old public school work,
thought nothing about it. Some of those were bloody sight more crude than I was, and than the old individual was. It doesn't say because they'd been well-educated, it sounds so that their morals were any better than mine. Oh, no, it's... Well, I know this one chap was with me in a place called Tidworth. I was sleeping next to a bloke, and he'd got orchitis. Now that's through venereal disease. His balls are so and so, and I know he'd got to go into the toilet to squirt his... It's bored. And they came into contact with that all the time, you see, those things. Venereal disease started to be talking about. And you've got, in camp, you see, you've got your notices for the next day. You know, order, I forget what they used to call it. The orders for the day were there anyhow. And more often than not at the bottom, Private so-and-so has been admitted to hospital with venereal disease. Nearly every day there was somebody on the thing, you see. And it was a general thing, that this venereal disease... I mean, right through the army, right through the war, it was the same thing. I mean, France, it was... In England, it was there, but in France, it was worse.
How about your sergeants, your corporals, the NCOs general, the instructors? What were they like?
Well, they were... the ordinary way, the sergeants, you see, they were regular. And they, generally speaking, they were, I won't say they were tyrants, but they were disciplinarians. Whereas when the battalion started making up the composition of officers, I mean, I'm talking about non-commissioned officers, like corporals and so on, they had to pick those from the ranks. You see, a man was promoted, say, to a lance corporal and corporal, and consequently he hadn't got the same stamp on him that a regular soldier had got. So, of course, he was more likeable, I should say. And they hadn't got that nasty business of bullying.
Do you think the disciplinarians were more efficient than the
Oh, they were more efficient, there's no question about it, you see, because if you've been drilled as if you've been drilled like a sergeant was in the army, I'm talking about in the regular army, all these fellows were, I mean, the army was tight, the discipline was tight, and they'd grown with it. And they still kept it, and they tried to pass it on to us. Because they could swear at the old soldiers, they thought they could swear at us. But we didn't like it. It was regular in the army, in the regular army. But when it came to us, they didn't realize who they were talking to. And they tried to bully us into it, you see. Of course, they didn't like it.
So they may have been efficient at drill, but they were perhaps not as efficient at man management.
Oh, no, they had no idea. I mean, you see, you got... you rebelled against a lot of it. You didn't like it, and sometimes if you could shirk a bit of something, you'd do so, you know. But in the ordinary way, you'd got to do what you were told. And that was it. I mean, if you didn't do what you were told, the sergeant said, as far as the sergeant's concerned, he was Lord God Almighty. And if he didn't like what you were doing, he said, if you're on it,